Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, those AMD flaws, they're getting fixed. My Digital SSD, great prices, but how about the performance? HP's MB X2 ARM laptop, a 1600-watt power supply, and VR updates from Oculus and Vive. All that and more. It's coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 458, recorded March 22nd, 2018. AMD vindicated and a bargain SSD. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show that aims to bring you lots and lots of computer hardware, mobile, desktop. We'll talk about consoles, handsets, tablets. And today, ladies and gentlemen, we will talk about what may be the best bargain available today in solid-state storage devices. Joining us, as you might guess from that last sentence, Mr. Alan Malventano of PC Per Storage Maven, an all-around nifty guy. How are you doing, Alan?
Good. How's it going?
I feel vindicated.
Why?
Okay. Well, one, I'm wearing the beard and the beard's completely out of control. And two, AMD's finally finished their technical assessment as of yesterday, sometime in the early hours of Wednesday morning. AMD finished their technical assessment of the CTS Labs research, which I like to summarize as it's not the Zen processors. Quote, these issues are associated with the firmware managing the embedded security control processor in some of our products. That's the AMD Secure processor. And the chipset used in some Socket AM4 and Socket TR4 desktop platforms supporting AMD processors. Turns out you actually need root access to the system to run any of the flaws that CTS Labs was quietly describing, which means you could do a lot worse faster. If you, I'll quote AMD again, any attacker gaining unauthorized administrative access would have a wide range of attacks at their disposal, well beyond the exploits identified in this research. Literally, like if you need root to execute a flaw, it still may be an awesome flaw, right? Because especially if it's running deep inside the processor and it's difficult to detect. But getting root access to a system is the point of most hacks and defended kind of, heavily against it. Most important, though, AMD says they will have fixes in a matter of weeks, not, quote, months or years, as CTS asserted. And AMD says they won't impact performance. This is a big deal, right? Because this company, CTS Labs, they did a bunch of pre-briefings with media. They did a pre-briefing with a company that has apparently a history of shorting stocks. The company that had the history of shorting stocks did their analysis. AMD stock prices deserve to be zero, and whatever
crap
you do when you're trying to make people panic and sell a perfectly functional stock. And the report was a little light on the detail, and AMD was given 24 hours. Now, 16 to 90 days would be a little more normal for a heads up. 24 hours is kind of ridiculous, but CTS was like, well, it's going to take them forever to fix this. Months, years, if at all. So we want everyone to know now, because they're screwed. And so the end result was all of this could have been fixed within 60 to 90 days, assuming AMD is telling the truth, and I have no reason to assume they aren't. And CTS looks like a bunch of people who made a big dramatic splash and probably will no longer be paid attention to in any meaningful fashion. Or if they are, or heaven forbid, if they do discover something amazing, everybody who covers that story is going to be like, of course, this is CTS Labs research. You may remember from their egregious violation of decency and trust with AMD. So in any case, those fixes are going to have to go through your motherboard. They're going to go from AMD to your motherboard manufacturer to you. This is a big deal, I think, for a number of reasons. Is one, there were some pretty significant flaws in Intel processors that the people who uncovered the flaws, Google, did a very, very good job of working behind the scenes with Google to get those patches put in place. Now, the patches ended up being broken and there was problems, but Intel, I think, owned up to that. maybe not as fast or as well as it would have liked to, but they did own up to that. And it would have been nice if they gotten the patches right the first time, but that's a whole nother conversation. But this is, you know, this is a big deal that, you know, it's slimy when a company comes out of nowhere, gives you no notice, slams your product, and it turns out the flaw, you know, because everybody's like, AMD Ryzen screwed. Well, it's not AMD Ryzen, right? It's the you know, the embedded security control and the firmware managing, which, you know, I should say the firmware managing the embedded security control and the chipset, which is bad enough, but I don't know. I would be curious, you know, was Ryan talking about this at PC Per this week at all, Alan?
Ryan's been out this week.
Is he on vacation?
This time he is. Usually when he's gone, he's working. This time he's gone and actually on a vacation.
Good for him.
Yeah, I was gone all the beginning of the week working.
I mean, I would be curious to hear his reaction because, you know, the news came out and it's like, ah, and then the secondary reaction was, this doesn't smell right. And now it's
That was our initial reaction too, especially since even initially they said, well, you have to have root. Like even in their own report, they're like, you have to already have root, which, I mean, all bets are off once you're at that point. You could basically do whatever the heck you want with the system, right? If you can get to the point where you can update a BIOS remotely, you know, onto a system, you pretty much own it. So, yeah. I mean, yeah, this made matters a little bit worse, and you could potentially do things that would, you know, some of their arguments bordered around, well, you could potentially get into the system, do some modifications within this architecture, and then actually, mm-hmm. you know, back out from any standpoint of anything you could scan for. So you could basically erase all of the normal traces that, you know, you would find on the system, basically nothing on the hard drive or the SSD. You can completely clean up after yourself, but then the hardware inside the system would be compromised sort of like at firmware level. Mm-hmm. And in that report, they were even going as far as saying, oh, there's no known way for AMD to fix this, as if, you know, you went in there and you did those changes, you could potentially make it so that you couldn't even like patch against it or whatnot. But
yeah, I mean, but
here AMD is a week later. We can patch this. So,
this is a case of, for example, not to be cruel or obnoxious, but, you know, one of my children, you know, being like, I don't think there's any way we can fix this car. And you or I walking up to the car and, you know, connecting the battery cable, right? This is not as simple as connecting a battery cable, but I feel this is pretty obvious that, you know, either CTS Labs was exaggerating for dramatic effect, or they have no delete expletive idea of what it takes to actually fix these. It's, you know, I am glad that the exploits are known and patches are being worked on, right? Because as you go through the list, you know, the link to this community.amd.com, where they do the corporate blog and, you know, firmware patch release through BIOS update, firmware patch release through BIOS update, no performance impact is expected. Mitigating patches released through BIOS update, no performance impact is expected. You've got a situation where a company found flaws and raised a big stink about it and made a judgment call, which I will say favoring themselves. That put the company in a bad light, put AMD in a bad light, put themselves in a bad light, and automatically signified that they may be able to find flaws, but they have no idea what it takes to mitigate them. So,
right. And, you know, I'd be hard pressed to think that AMD would have had a separate processor within their architecture that was not updatable somehow. Yeah. Right. Like, you're not going to make a thing that has a firmware that you can't possibly do an update to. That's just, I mean, I guess it's possible that they could have went that way with it, but
that's for audio manufacturers.
Yeah. It would be really foolish to make something like that not updatable. Now, I mean, there is, you know, there is a parallel to that, and that's the Intel Management Engine stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Which also is firmware updatable, but, you know, if not in a sort of being hacked way. The normal process to update this firmware is that you need some sort of a public-private key, like a, you know, trusted code sort of thing, right? You need some way to prove to the device that this is a legit firmware. And, you know, you'd figure the same kind of thing, you know, would apply here on these AMD parts, although these guys there were, you know, that were obviously doing these hacks figured out a way around that, right? They were figuring out how to get code in there outside of the normal trusted method, so that they can kind of inject whatever the heck they wanted in there, which was sure was bad. But again, you need root access. I mean, you're basically at the point where you have you're almost physical access to the system at that point.
If you have root access,
you're basically sitting in front of it.
Yeah, you have access to every single function and aspect, and you have total control of the system at that point, at least until somebody cuts the cable you're connected over.
Right. So anything that's an exploit, you know, yes, it makes you have even more capability once you have root, but really the hardest thing is actually getting root in the first place. You know, if getting root of a system was a willy-nilly thing that just anybody can pull off in this world, then pretty much everybody would be hacked all the time. So,
It boggles the mind. That's all I'm going to say. In completely different news from a radically different source, an exclusive story on Variety, that's the newspaper of record for the Hollywood entertainment community. Facebook plans to launch Oculus Go VR headset at F8 Developer Conference, which is another way of saying May 1st. F8's essentially where Facebook gathers its developers together. And it's funny that this news came out, given everything else that's going on at Facebook this week, which we will not get into. But Oculus Go is their standalone system. It's going to be selling for $199. Basically, that was the word we got back in October. And I will be very curious to say how long it will take them if they ship it May 1st or how long it's going to be, because they said it was going to be early in 2018. It's essentially it's a Samsung Gear VR, except it's not. I will be very curious to see what the performance is like, what people will think it is, you know, how it compares to Oculus. Will they do versions of the existing Oculus games? There's a $199 for 32 gigs of onboard storage, 64 gigabytes are going to cost a little bit more. You won't be able to lean into your VR experience, because there's no positional tracking. So it's going to be a little more static than the Rift, but I'm curious to see how these do. Right, we saw the headset from Lenovo that we saw at CES is coming up on sale. We've seen all the updates from various manufacturers. I'm curious to see if enough games start evolving on these platforms to make people interested, or I want to know what the software experience is going to be like, or if a lot of the Oculus games will be ported to this hardware.
Yeah.
You sound really bored. Like me.
No. I'm just trying
just
to
fight head cold. Headset. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm kind of like meh about that, because there's so many ifs and buts, and you have to wait for people to try to port releases from one platform to another. It's already a mess trying to get Rift releases on the Vive and vice versa. I mean, sure, there's some releases that overlap on both, but they're doing the whole thing where there's some games that are only on Rift, there's some games that are only on Vive, and you can't get them on the opposite platform, and you have to start doing hacky stuff to try to make one thing work on the other. Now you're going to throw another one in there and just kind of hope and pray that the developers are all willing to, port their stuff over. So I'm sure some will. It's just that VR in general has a hard enough time as it is catching on. You don't need a Blu-ray versus HD DVD style thing added into the mix, or the equivalent of it as far as the platforms of software.
Right.
In
other news, maybe a little bit more exciting, at least for me, HTC's dropped the price of the Vive to $499. I have been waiting so long. And they are finally opened up pre-orders for the $799 Vive Pro that was announced at CES. Shannon got eyeballs on with the Vive Pro and gushed about it profusely, significantly mostly about the higher resolution. So this is cool.
Mm-hmm. I'm happy about the first part. I'm not that happy about the second part, specifically the price, right? The first part, dropping the price of the whole Vive unit, like with all the, beacons and lighthouses and all the, all the parts you need, right? Dropping that to $500 is great. That needed to happen. It honestly needed to happen last year.
A while ago.
But the Vive Pro, you already have to have the Vive, because the Vive Pro only comes with a replacement headset. You already have to have had the other unit. So, unless I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's what it is. I thought it was headset only. Because they say within that documentation that it's compatible with both the first and second generation lighthouses. So if that's the case, like it's sort of implied at least that all you're getting is a headset there. You're not getting the whole unit. So what if you didn't already have one and you're very interested in the Vive Pro?
Like, then say you're spending more money.
Right. Say that was your threshold, right? Say you had tried VR in the past. You didn't like the screen door or the aliasing, or just that the resolution was just kind of too low for your threshold, right? You're like, okay, Vive Pro, that's going to get me in the door. Now you're looking at $800 plus $500, and you're not going to use all the parts because you're just going to take the standard def headset that came with the original one, and you're not even going to take it out of the box. You're just going to use the Vive Pro. So that's part one. Part two is, I already own a Vive. I already have all the stuff. I am a perfect person for the whole, like, yes, I actively use this thing. I want to have higher resolution. I have the hardware to back it up. I'm like the target market for this, and I did not pre-order it because $800 for only the headset. I don't care how good the resolution is. That's too much money for just the headset. If it was the headset and it came with everything else, and then I could sell off the previous one to sort of justify the upgrade, then sure. But I'm not just going to spend $800 on just one piece upgrade to a complete other setup. That's just that's past my threshold, and I think it's past a lot of people's threshold. We'll find out once the shipping date actually comes up and see if suddenly they, not only are we shipping all the pre-orders, but surprise, we have the full package now for, you know, actually, I think it was Ken at PC Prairie. It was our discussions at the office. We're like, $800 should be the price of the whole kit with the upgraded headset. Not just the headset by itself.
Right. Interesting. Yeah, that's kind of frustrating.
The price is really high. Again, super impressive. We've had guys that have looked, put the new headset on, and they were very impressed, and the resolution was very good, easily to the point where, the resolution is high enough that the aliasing is not so much of an issue. You just have to be cautious that you have hardware good enough to drive that increased resolution at 90 frames per second without issues and drop frames and whatnot. As long as you can check those boxes, then sure. It looks like kind of how you would have hoped it would have been when it first launched, as far as, how good it looks, which is great.
I'm curious what the Vive Pro kit is going to cost, like the complete Vive Pro.
I feel like they're charging this now, and it's like the early adopter tax.
Right.
If they came out with a Vive Pro kit, I think they'd have to be close to this price because the kit wouldn't come out until later on. Right, so the price has to come down some relatively. Yeah.
It's also because, one of the things The Verge points out is that HTC is on the record for saying they're going to keep the original system going through at least 2018, which makes me wonder if they plan on sort of pushing that as hard as they... It seems like they probably want to make as much margin as they can on the Vive Pro for as long as they can, because they don't have the pockets that Facebook does to absorb a cut in hardware price.
Yeah, and that sounds reasonable. And they have sort of silently been updating the original kit over time, right? When I got my kit, it's the first generation lighthouses. It's the cable on the headset is like a three cable bundle. Like it's kind of bulky and it sits kind of flat like a ribbon, whereas the newer versions have upgraded the cable to a thinner cable that's just a single round cable. They managed to fit the USB and the HDMI all into like one bundle, which makes it a little bit easier and not as kind of like bulky to kind of like drag around the room with you as you're moving around. And they've also updated the lighthouses to a newer version. The old style lighthouses had two rotating, basically hard drive motors in them, with one laser sweeps, a horizontal sweep one way and a vertical sweep the other way, and they're both kind of interleaved with each other. The second generation Lighthouse only has a single rotor that has two diagonal sweeps, basically kind of like one goes down diagonally and then the next one goes down, you know, 90 degrees opposed diagonally. Basically accomplishes the same end result, just with a single moving part instead of two, which is, you know, better overall for the system. You only need one laser. You don't need two. You're just splitting the laser across a couple of different beams. So, you almost cut all the parts in half for the Lighthouse. So that potentially made it cheaper to produce. So, you know, they've been progressing on all these fronts. It's just now, now they just kind of need to like make it into a Vive Pro like whole thing. Maybe they're waiting on something else. Maybe they're going to make everything blue, right? Because the Vive Pro is like this dark blue color. So maybe they're going to make a newer version of the kit where all of the parts of the kit are a dark blue instead of the black that the first generation is. You know, maybe they'll do some other stylistic kind of like changes to the rest of the hardware. But, you know, I could see them kind of holding off on that for as long as possible because they're probably not moving a lot of volume, right? You wouldn't imagine that these things, you know, move with a very large relative volume. So when you think of mass production style things, they probably have a decent amount of just parts kind of lying around to be able to put into systems. So they're going to have to sell through, you know, all the older stuff sufficiently before they can start doing something like a Vive Pro kit with, you know, a whole new round of hardware, right?
We'll see.
Yeah, and we'll be waiting. I could see them doing a Vive Pro kit with the wireless headset, right? Because that was another thing they talked about when they first talked about the Vive Pro. There was the Intel WidEye style, you know, whatever it is, I forget how many gigahertz of a signal it was, but it was line of sight and it could only had a range of like, you know, 20 or 30 feet or something because of the sheer bandwidth that you're sending over the airwaves. I could see them doing a kit that maybe they're waiting on that wireless portion and they're going to do all of it for something like that's maybe $1,000. Right? That would make sense to me. And maybe that's actually the reason why there's not a kit yet for the Pro, at least. Because you would think a Pro kit would probably be a true wireless VR experience, room scale, which would be good. Right?
Well, we shall see. I also should point out that some of the early hands-on reports on the Oculus Go is that it feels pretty good and considerably less clunky, I think was the word somebody was using, compared to the Gear VR. In a completely out-of-the-blue random note, those crazy kids at Magic Leap, who are going to have the super bestest, most awesomest augmented reality ever, they said they were going to have an SDK in 2016? It's been so long, I forget.
It's overdue either way.
Yeah, by several years. In any case, Magic Leap tweeted out that their creator portal is ready for exploration. Download the SDK, visit the forums, and preview all the new tools. So, supposedly, Magic Leap's presenting at GDC this week. I have not seen any stories on that yet, but I will be very curious to see what Magic Leap looks like if and when it ever ships.
Oh, speaking of things that VR related and if and ever ships, I know this is not in the notes, but Budget Cuts is supposed to be released on May 16th.
Budget Cuts
was the VR, like you're a secret agent and you're like throwing daggers at robots sort of thing, where you kind of like you jump through a portal is the teleportation method in the VR game. There's a demo of it. It's probably my favorite VR game, but the demo came out like 2 years ago now.
Right.
And it was just, and they only had like two or three levels in the demo, and it was just, it's such a catchy game and like so, just, I mean, it's truly a fun game, seriously. And it's just so disappointing that it we have had to wait. It's turned into like, you know, a Duke Nukem for VR titles because they keep working on it.
Right.
But May 16th, that's supposed to be the date. And hopefully no backsies. It's supposed to be $30 too, which is a decent price for a VR game that's supposed to give you like, you know, multiple hours worth of playtime easy and probably a good amount of replayability. So I will be there with bells on for that one. And the books on my bookshelves and all of the stuff in my office will be knocked off of everything when that game comes out because this is the room where I use the Vive, so nothing is safe.
Nothing is safe, people. Nothing is safe. I just want to point out that at this point, Magic Leap has received $2.3 billion in funding, according to the Crunchbase.
Probably a decent amount of government funding in there.
No, actually.
Probably a decent amount of undisclosed government funding in there.
Yeah, except just the guessing. Numbers, I think, add up. I mean, you know, you're looking at Warner Brothers, Morgan Stanley, Fidelity, Alibaba, Axel Springer, Saudi Arabia, and the Round D. I bring this up just because they have taken so much money, they're going to have to sell these to everyone pay all of the VC back. Just thinking. Something I'm excited about. We talked about this last time Alan was on My Digital SSD, a brand nobody's heard of, producing SSDs, NVMe SSDs, at prices comparable to non-NVMe SSD drives by other manufacturers. We're talking about seriously low prices. Now, Alan can walk us through the performance numbers for My Digital SSDs, SBX M.2, NVMe in 128, 256, 512, and 1 terabyte. He has run the tests. Are you as excited about these drives as you were before you had a chance to test the performance?
Yeah, so the thing that excites me about a drive like this is that you don't always need the fire-breathing product, right?
Right.
Like, you don't always need the 1080 Ti. You don't always need the 18-core Xeon, right? Well, the SSD equivalent of that is, it'd be nice to have an NVMe SSD that's a small form factor, but also not have it limited to serial ATA speeds, right? They do have M.2 that uses serial ATA as an interface. There are plenty of products out there that are that way. You can get the small form factor, but you're kind of cut off at the knees as, you know, you're limited to 500 meg per second, 550 meg per second. There's a lot of people that they want more speed, but they don't necessarily need like 3.5 gig per second, you know, on the high end, right? And as soon as you make that jump, you're pretty much doubling the cost of the SSD, even though it's a smaller part. And a much smaller form factor, you're kind of paying for the better performance, right? If you want something like a 960 Evo or a 960 Pro from Samsung, you're gonna pay more money. It'd be nice if we can get things a little bit closer to the products that connect via SATA, be it a 2.5 inch or a M.2 part. It'd be nice if we get the price closer to that, but at the same time, still be able to use that NVMe interface, still be able to get slightly better latencies for requests, but maybe not the straight line dragster style speed of those same parts, right? And the answer to that is to use only 2 lanes of PCI Express versus 4 lanes of PCI Express. So that's what's going on here. These SBX SSDs are using a Phison, I believe it's a Phison E8 controller that they make it both ways. They make it with a DRAM cache and without. In case you wanted to save even more cost, because as we know, DRAM is kind of expensive. These do come with the DRAM cache on them. That cache is the translation layer, basically the table where these SSDs need to do their look up where is the data stored within the flash. So you kind of need some DRAM on an SSD to make sure the performance stays good. So they included that part. They didn't skimp. But the Phison controller is only 2 channels of PCI Express. That brings the cost of the controller down. The performance, obviously, your straight line performance, like your sequential transfers, those are going to be cut in half compared to something with 4 lanes. You're literally taking, you know, removing 2 lanes from the interface. So stands to reason, you know, you get half the bandwidth. But again, if you're in a system where you're okay with a gig per second or a gig and a half per second, as opposed to something like, you know, 3 gig per second, then you know, it's still better than the half of a gig per second of serial ATA, right? So if you go to that client QD weighted page of the review, it's probably the easiest just to wrap performance up. And you go to that same chart or the first chart there. So there's your 4K random performance. And what you want to focus on is the blue bars. So there's your basically random read performance as you would experience it. You know, that this is a weighted result. It takes a bunch of factors into account and tries to get you as close to the actual feel of the SSD with you just sitting in front of the computer. You're trying to do something with random reads, booting up a system that has, you know, 3,000 desktop icons and 25 apps. loading in the system tray at boot and everything. Like, you're basically hitting the SSD with a bunch of random performance. Now, those numbers next to the blue bars do not move around very much. You know, we're in the 17,000 range for these SPX parts. Now, that does kind of fall off as you go to the lower capacities because there's less flash for you to access in parallel. So it kind of loses a little bit of the benefit, you know, and the throughput drops down a little bit because there's just less media to access. But for the most part, you're around 16,000 range for performance for these, which is actually very good when you consider that 960 Evo runs in the 20,000 range. So you're going from the 20,000s down to 16,000s. Yes, you're taking a hit, but it's only like, you know, 15, 20%. It's not a huge drop in random performance. And another thing that's interesting to note there is, look one up from the bottom there. That's an 860 Evo. That's a serial ATA part. Serial ATA is not really that much slower than, you know, than the NVMe part on low Q-depth random reads. And that's because the media is still basically the same. It's still NAND flash on the other end of the controller. And that flash still takes X amount of time to read something. It's just that NVMe shaves a little bit off of the transfer to the host time. You know, the flash memory access still ends up being roughly the same. All right, so if you go to the sequentials there, which is the next chart, you'll notice, 960 Evo is just going to walk all over stuff, right? It's over doing over 2.2 gig per second throughput there. But when you drop down to these parts, and again, this is a weighted result for sequential. It's not going to give you the maximum possible sequential speed. It's going to give you what the system would probably experience in more realistic use. So that drops down to, you know, like 750 or so meg per second. But again, serial ATA parts are running at 500. So you're doing, again, you're doing better than serial ATA in both random and sequential performance. But the key here is that if you go to the last page of the review where we have pricing, is that you're doing it for around 30 cents per gig. And that's just, you know, that's just the going price right now. Like, that's literally, you can go to mydigitaldiscount.com and you can buy these parts for those prices. And these guys have a habit of being pretty flexible with the market. Like, as the prices of other things change, they have no qualms about dropping their prices mid stride. These prices had actually just, these prices had actually just dropped to these numbers a few days before this review went live. So I actually had to update my numbers before I posted the review because the prices had actually gone down even further, right?
Right.
You know, so decent drives, like 5-year warranty. The endurance looks good. The price is great. You know, I mean, they're beating Samsung SATA SSD prices even. So, you know, if you can get an NVMe part that can beat Samsung SATA SSD price, unless you specifically after a SATA SSD for some particular reason, in my opinion, the M.2 stuff is, you know, much more convenient, especially if you have any recent motherboard or motherboard that's come out in the past few years. Chances are there's an M.2 slot on there. You know, so if, as long as you're okay with one SSD or just SSDs in the M.2 form factor, this is almost a no-brainer, right? Decent part, performs well, good price, pretty much all you can ask for, you know, in an SSD, unless you're in some really niche case where you're trying to do really crazy workloads and you want super, super low latency, then I'd say, you know, start looking at Optane stuff. But, you know, if you're going to get something with NAND on it, this is decent SSD, good NAND, good numbers, you know, it's worth it. So this is the kind of thing where I would, like, default recommendation for some random buddy asks you which SSD you should buy, right? I would probably point to these right now because that's going to, you know, he's not going to have to go to the bank at second mortgage's house.
Capacity. Just needs to do that for his GPU. And you know, if you're not a video editor or working with like 2 terabyte SQL files or some of the more, you know, out of control data moving situations.
Right. And even if you are and you just want your boot drive to be separate, because a lot of people that are kind of power users that do a lot of that stuff might also tend to be purists in that they're going to have the drive, the right drive for the right duty, right? So if you want, if you wanted to have, you know, 480 gig, 900p Optane SSD to beat the tar out of, but have it as a secondary drive because you don't want to try to squeeze your OS, your games, and everything else on it, it'd be good to use this as your primary drive and then beat the heck out of the other one, or vice versa, right? You're looking for a big Steam game drive. You already have something like 900p that you're booting from, but you don't want to buy another 900p just for Steam games. And if anything, they don't even make them more than 480 gig. So if you're looking for a good 1 terabyte Steam game drive and you have an M.2 slot to use, by all means, I mean, that's, you know, $300 for 1 terabyte. That's not even a sale. That's just their price.
There you have it.
Can't go wrong there either. Yeah.
If you carry a drive, nervous about the drive being damaged, portable drive, mobile drive, we've seen several efforts over the years to create drives that are difficult to kill, if you will. Latest one we've seen in a long time, Jim Tanis did the write-up for PC Purr, CalDigit's tough, rugged, external drive. And, you know, it is somewhat less terrifying to carry around than your average hard drive, mostly because it is sealed and armored, that electric snot zombie ammo green wrapping on there is your basic bumper that wraps around the enclosure. It comes in a fancy box that holds the the archive box is what CalDigit calls it, a travel case, right, that holds your cables in the box itself to give it some additional protection. There is a little tab you can put over the USB drawer. I always get nervous when I see ruggedized or you know, waterproof USB drives that have those tabs, because I always wonder, like, do I have to have that tab in there to get the performance I'm looking for in terms of being waterproof? It's a mechanical hard drive, so the performance is not nearly as spectacular as some of the other stuff you've seen. They did make sure, Jim did make sure that the cover was in place before he dumped it in water. It's a basic, mil-spec level of waterproofness, so 1 meter for up to 30 minutes. So it's drop in the toilet proof or drop in a puddle proof or, drop in waterproof. You just don't want to leave it for very long. And if it goes to the bottom of the swimming pool, you really want to get to it fast because, again, it's only rated for 1 meter, which is not a spectacular depth if you've ever made mistakes around water. Pricing is about what you would expect for a drive like this. If I click on the right link, I will actually see the pricing on there. A little more expensive than a typical hard drive, external hard drive enclosure. There it is. It's always at the end of the article, and some days I just can't get there. It's considerably more expensive, actually, than a typical external hard disk drive, because 2 terabytes, Western Digital or Seagate drives are typically selling for under $100, at least where I shop. The SSDs, of course, are considerably more expensive because it's a $300 1 terabyte SSD. But if you are looking for something, I like how Jim puts it, if you expect a high likelihood of environmental hazards, it's not a bad idea, and certainly much easier than remembering to take your drive, put it in a Pelican case or an OtterBox, close and lock the Pelican case or OtterBox, and then remove it next time. But good review up on PC Purr, and remember, tougher drives cost more. That's just the way life works, people. Another thing to think about, Qualcomm HP Envy X2, big deal. Earlier this year, there's going to be Windows running on ARM. It's going to be a regular version of Windows. Laptop Mag had the first review I think I've seen of any of them, HP's Envy X2. Quote, one of the first always connected Windows on ARM PCs. It's sluggish, but packs amazing battery life with a great keyboard and display. And HP's Envy's have been very, very nice. They have a nice feeling keyboard. They've been doing a really good job with the screens. Big step up from some of the stuff we were seeing from HP a few years ago. And they went to Bang & Olufsen for some audio tuning, but there's only so much audio you can do with something that's as skinny as that computer. 4G LTE is kind of the big deal of these laptops, right? LTE is built in. And the reviewer says most of the time he was using it, it was great. Henry T. Casey over at Laptop Mag. And he was using it, basically around and about, if you will. Apps, he says, quote, such as Outlook, requested permission to use mobile bandwidth upon opening and proceeded to work well, refreshing themselves with new emails from the server even after I closed the case and put the system to sleep. Testing our connection on speedtest.net, I got an average download rate of 41.3 megabytes per second and an average upload rate of 9.3 megabytes per second. It's nice that it's giving you a warning on that one. He notes that you probably want to put this on an unlimited plan with other devices. Windows 10 S is the standard operating system for this. It's a 32-bit machine. Quote, out of the box, that means you can't run the Chrome browser or a variety of other popular apps that aren't in the Windows Store. Because almost none of our benchmark tester apps we want to use would run in S mode, we upgraded the X2 to Windows 10 Pro, a free process that takes about 60 seconds. So battery life is crazy. He said it took 14 hours and 22 minutes of constant web surfing on Wi-Fi to drain the Envy X2 of its charge. Performance, well, Qualcomm 835s are pretty badass for Android, not so badass for running Windows, especially Windows when you only have 4 gigabytes of RAM. So keep an eye on that. And if you run a lot of non-Windows applications, that could be more problematic for performance. In any case, Laptop Mag has a great review, HP Envy's X2, the Qualcomm-powered beast. And while we're talking about beasts, I feel like we mentioned this last week, but the review wasn't up. Lead a review of Corsair's AX1600i digital ATX power supply. 1600 watts. It's 103.3 amps on the 12 volt outputs.
You're in arc welding territory there.
Yeah, 18 plus titanium certified for super high efficiency, which is great if you're using that much. Is this built for miners?
Either that or just crazy workstation with a bunch of GPUs in it, you know. I don't know if it's specifically built for miners, right? Because, if you're a lot of the miners that are going that crazy will tend to buy like server power supplies to power a lot of the GPU. Like so server PSUs will come and you can get like a 1200 watt power supply, but it's only a 12 volt rail is the problem. Because a lot of the server hardware that uses those power supplies will have a regulator that gives you the other voltages. Outside of the hot swappable power supply thing. So guys that are going crazy about mining stuff, they'll just, they'll have a regular small power supply to deal with the motherboard and maybe one or two of the GPUs, and then they'll have like server PSUs powering the rest of them.
Right.
But again, you still need a crazy high current power supply if you're doing workstation stuff with, you want to do 4 1080 Ti's in a Xeon workstation or 4 like Titan V's or something like that, do rendering or whatnot. You need one of these. Even though you can't SLI fast too, you can still render and do, GPU compute stuff with, I don't know if 4 is even the limit anymore, but it usually is as far as like how many slots you have to physically plug them in in the system. Yep.
Yep.
There's a decent number there of that's basically the perfect number you need for 4 high-end GPUs, and then there's an extra couple of additional 8 pins there, and those would go to your CPU power on a high-end like workstation, potentially even like a dual Xeon board. So definitely enough power there for pretty much anything in a single system you could throw at it.
In case you're wondering what a digital power supply is, Lee writes, quote, it incorporates digital signal processing on both the primary and secondary sides, which allows the PSU to deliver extremely tight voltage regulation over a wide range of loads. And second, the A1600i features the digital Corsair link, which enables the power supply unit to be connected to the PC's motherboard for real-time monitoring, efficiency voltage regulation, and power usage, and control for overcurrent protection and fan speed profiles. And there is a semi-fanless mode, which is kind of incredibly ridiculous for a 1600-watt power supply. but the option is there should you be feeling the need.
There's an interesting question in the chat, which we should address here. And they're asking, when are we going to see 240-volt PSUs? Well, I got news for you. Pretty much all PSUs are also 240-volt PSUs. Like, switching power supplies will generally... No, there's not even switches anymore. Power supplies will generally have a dynamic, you know, switching power supplies, at least, can generally just operate on a range of voltages. And usually it's from like 100 volts all the way up to like 250 volts. And they, you know, they can, in some cases, they can produce even like they can output even more power at the higher input voltage, or they operate more efficiently, or both. You know, a lot of power supplies, you can get something like a 5% efficiency gain in power supply efficiency just because you're operating on a higher input voltage.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. Oh, my goodness. In the incredibly speculative but intriguing department, Bloomberg Technology has a write-up on Apple, who apparently is secretly developing its own screens. Micro-LED technology, do not expect those at the announcement on June 4th. And yes, we will be keeping our eyeballs all peeled and excited for the June 4th announcement, where we're supposed to hear more about next-generation MacBooks and iOS devices. I am very curious to see what Apple does with phones. And if they do, if they kind of up the value proposition, because I have heard more complaints about sort of the Mac ecosystem in terms of, you know, not from Windows enthusiasts complaining about the cost of Macintosh hardware or mocking the cost of Macintosh hardware, but for Macintosh users who are finally like, I'm done. I'm leaving OS X because I'm not getting what I need from the hardware configurations that are available. So I'm kind of curious to see what the future looks like, or if they even get into the laptops at this event in June. It's going to be interesting, to say the least. And I'm trying to figure out if there's any... I think that pretty much wraps it up, man. Anything we didn't get to that you wanted to mention on the show today, Alan?
No, nothing yet. There's some pretty good stuff coming in a couple weeks. I'm just, you know... Random little catch-up storage pieces for me for the next week or two. I'm sure there'll be a bunch of other good stuff related with the fact that both Ken and Ryan are out on a... Well, Ryan's out on vacation, but Ken's out on, on assignment, so to speak.
On assignment.
And I was previously out on assignment. However, I am not allowed to disclose what I saw just yet, but it was good stuff.
Bet I can guess what it was. In the second guessing is an art form. Uber had suspended testing of its autonomous vehicles in Arizona after one of them struck a pedestrian. The declaration was that the pedestrian was, I believe, if I didn't misread the story, was that the vehicle was not at fault.
Yeah. The manner by which the pedestrian came out into the street was something that, like, even the human would have had a hard time, you know, A, identifying, and B, responding quickly enough.
I mean, having been a human who ran out from behind a parked car in front of a Buick moving at high speed circa 1979, I can relate to it not being the driver's fault. But of course, the round of next generation round of reporting is coming out, which is experts are now claiming that a human driver could have avoided the fatal Uber crash.
I mean, possibly. I mean, there was a human. I don't know if the human that was in the car was paying attention enough. Maybe that's the point, is that they should have been more aware. You know, because there is a difference between the car's driving and you're just watching, and you actually driving the car. There's a different level of attentiveness there, whether you want to believe it or not.
I will say I am, over the last couple of years, as more and more electric vehicles accumulate in our neighborhood and in the community I live in, I've become more and more intent about visual confirmation of there not being vehicles around, because it's amazing. One of my next door neighbors has an electric vehicle, and you know, it's amazing how quiet that thing is, especially if something's going on or the wind is blowing. You know, just a warning out there. You know, look left, look right, look left, and probably, you know, do that one more time, because some of these cars are really, really, really quiet. On that slightly terrifying note, keep an eye on PC Per next week. There's going to be some announcements that Alan and Ken cannot talk about this week. We should be having some fun with some Raspberry Pis next week. You know, we looked at the new Raspberry Pi 3 Model B Plus last week on Tech Thing. And, you know, if you're curious about Netflix 4K, boy, oh boy. We talk a lot about that this week on Tech Thing, and show off a high-speed look at the building of most of our studio, if you're into that kind of thing. So check that out. And a bunch of interesting information on mobile data, including we've had some viewers that are consistently getting well over 100 gigabytes a month without hitting a cap, despite the fact that they're supposed to hit a cap at around 20 or 50 gigabytes. Something to think about there. It's coming up on is up on techthing.com, and we're going to have some fun with some Raspberry Pi stuff next week. With that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. You have been listening, if this is new to you, to Tech Thing. No, you've been listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. It's been a while since I've had a good brain fart, a.k.a. Twitch. You can find all of our older episodes and information on how to subscribe at twit.tv/Twitch. And you can find more of Mr. Malventano over at pcper.com. You can find more of me. Well, we already told you all about that. So, hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening. I'm Patrick Norton.
Oh, no, I was muted.
And we'll see you next week on Twitch.